Okay, now today we're talking about the biblical view of government and immigration. And we're just going to essentially dive in and look at some of the topics I isolated within this group. I spent a long time. This is such a huge topic of we can't cover everything. So focusing in on a few things in particular. And then we can let the conversation take us wherever it wants. But here's the outline of God. We're going to talk about government, basically the biblical view of government and how does government work. Is it biblical to have governments at all, et cetera. Talking about immigration, since that's such a hot-button issue right now within our government. What's the biblical view of immigration? Yeah, should we be building a wall or not? And then we're going to talk a little bit about political parties and the U.S. government in particular and how we get involved with our government and how do we, as Christians, what's the proper perspective to have while being involved in our government. But to start with, government, we're going to look at two topics underneath that in particular, civil disobedience and separation of church and state. These are two pretty common things that Christians have to deal with government. But to begin with, some questions to spur on the discussion. How should Christians behave towards their government?
In obedience, because God could set them in authority over us.
Okay.
As long as it doesn't go against what he has said in the Bible.
And how do you know that?
By knowing the Bible.
Yep.
By testing it through Scripture.
What should the ideal philosophy or system of government be in a Christian nation? You know, we have a democratic republic. We've seen Christians living in, fascist totalitarian states, monarchies, anarchistic rule. What's the best Christian way to run a nation?
Anarchy. The one that, which is technically,
it wouldn't be the people rule. It would be
you mean communism?
God rules the people.
God rules the people like he was back in Israel back in the day before Saul.
So you're talking theocratic monarchy.
Yeah.
Or theocratic dictatorship.
Amen.
Theocracy.
Theocracy. Yeah. That would be the best way to do it. But
what about communism? Like we see in Acts 4. That's communism, right?
That sounds like
that's the Christian... We'll talk a little bit about
what's
that.
American.
What's the definition of anarchy?
No rules.
No government
at all. Gotcha. Arche is the Greek word for rule or ruler, and an is the negation. So, no rules. It's anarchy. I will show you how the root of that word is Greek. Should we care?
Yes.
Usually.
Why? As Christians, our citizenship is somewhere else, right?
Yes.
But I mean,
in the Lord's kingdom, where he rules.
Best to spread his word. I mean, we're still abiding by rules, by the rules set before us in the Bible, and the government that best allows us to follow those rules and...
We're still people living on Earth right now, so we have to be able to figure something out.
Deal with it.
Well,
that's fair.
I will say something, not against what you're saying, but something that would be interesting to think about, is I read an article about the church in China, where the pastors, because you know how very repressive it is against Christianity, the pastors there were saying, we don't pray for this to go away, because... like, somewhat have it loosened, but the church grows so much.
Under persecution.
With the persecution. You know, the ones who aren't really Christians, they're not there, they just fall away, so you're left with the true body of believers. And I guess because there's such a difference in Christians versus the ones who don't have any kind of God, like in China...
Or the state
is their God.
But at some point, you're going to reach a halt of having all of the true believers and not being able to reach out to the non-believers, which in a repressed state would mean a environment where you, to reach the non-believers, you would be putting yourself in jail or being put to death.
Paul was put in jail.
Interesting.
I'm not saying that you shouldn't be put in jail if that was to happen, but I'm saying at least in America we can go up to a non-believer or a believing Christian and say
express
what we feel. Express what we feel.
Good. All right. This is good. That's what I wanted to happen. thinking about government. First of all, the question of civil disobedience comes up. Are we allowed to disobey the authorities put over us?
I think we are morally obligated to disobey unjust laws.
We're morally obligated to disobey unjust laws. Well put.
And more.
That's a quote from Martin Luther King.
I knew somebody else must have put it that way.
Ooh. I saw it on Instagram.
I knew someone else must have
put it. Worldview. Worldview. They're forward and forward.
Yeah, he was up here for a minute there, wasn't he?
Yeah. A brief.
You should have just left it. You should have respected it.
It's still agreeing.
There are three logical options when it comes to disobedience. Either no, we're not allowed to disobey, ever, called radical patriotism. We're always required to obey, regardless of what they say. You're never allowed to disobey. You're always allowed to disobey. Which is anarchy, anarchism. Or the middle view is sometimes, it depends. Which I've termed willful submission. As in, yes, I'll obey at these times, but if I so will, I will not.
Relative submission.
Biblically speaking, we'll start with anarchism. No biblical support for anarchism. Nowhere does it say, anywhere in the Bible, disobey the authorities put over you. In fact, from day one, creation, we had God over man, and he gave them a rule to follow. And they disobey it, and bad stuff happens. So, from the get-go, pretty much anarchism has no biblical support. Also,
everyone did what was right in their own eyes.
There you go. Theme of Judges. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And we get to the end of the book of Judges, and some pretty awful things are happening. Genesis 9 is also a key passage when we're talking about government, the right to rule, for certain human beings to make rules over other human beings. Do you know the context of Genesis 9?
From the flood.
Yeah.
I read it this week for my worldview class.
Nice.
It also says it right
there. So yeah.
That too, but I read it from...
Good. But no, you got it. The flood. They get off the boat, and God makes a covenant with Noah in chapter 9. And so I'll read this to you, chapter 9, verse 1. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." You recognize that from when he created Adam and Eve. "The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heaven, upon everything that creeps upon the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything." So this is where most people would argue that humans were not carnivorous prior to the flood, and this is when we began rightfully eating animals for food. Verse 4, "But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, with its blood. And for you, life blood, I will require a reckoning. For every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image." So, that last phrase is the one that most people know and refer to. "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed." Essentially giving Noah the right to exact punishment for, in this case, murder, is what it seems like. Whoever sheds the blood of man, government, whoever the ruling authority is, has the right to shed that man's blood.
Capital punishment.
This is where most people would argue that the idea of government enters the scene on the earth. And, the real question then is, does it continue? And you got to read the whole Bible and say, so when the Mosaic comes along, does that Mosaic law comes along, does that trump Genesis 9 with the Noahic covenant? Or does this continue and does it still continue? And I would argue that it still continues. One that is an unending covenant. Various places all throughout, particularly the New Testament, so much more directly applicable, you don't have that whole, is this still in effect kind of a thing, different dispensation. Romans 13 is the classic passage on that would kind of seem to directly renounce anarchism. Somebody want to read Romans 13, 1 through 7 for me? And somebody else want to be looking up 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17?
I got Romans 13.
All right, go for it, Clint.
1 through 7?
Yeah.
Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. But you have no fear of the one who is in authority. And do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger, and carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed.
All right, so right from the very beginning, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, the people who are the government in your situation. You are subject under them. The reason, what reason does he give? It's like second sentence in that verse.
God appointed him.
God appointed him. There is no authority except from God. So, whatever authority you're under, God's sovereign. He knows that you're under that authority and he put you there. So whoever resists these authorities resists what God has appointed. Those who resist will incur judgment. He continues on. He starts to almost, the skeptic could argue, backpedal. He starts bringing morality into it. So this is why we talked about morality last week in truth. You're going to see that morality enters into all of these conversations. He says, after telling you to respect the authorities, rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. So, whoever is in authority over you, the government, is supposed to be promoting the good and discouraging the bad. Intrinsically moral, right? Who says what's good and what's bad? God does. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good. You will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do what is wrong, be afraid. He does not bear the sword in vain. So if you're doing what is good, theoretically, you shouldn't be have anything to fear about submitting to the authorities, because the authorities are supposed to be doing what is good. Yeah.
Well, are you done?
No. But,
okay.
Remember, too, what authority Paul is under at this point.
He's a Pharisee.
Well, he's a Pharisee. He's a Christian at this point, obviously. Oh, okay. But what? Who's the government in charge? In particular, who's the emperor? Nero is the particular Caesar. Caesar's term that means king, emperor. Nero is the emperor in question during the time of this reign.
Way back.
Yeah, like the second second lesson of history. He's one of the worst guys to ever persecute the church. He went around, he burned down Rome and blamed the Christians for it. He was constantly running around killing Christians because he viewed them as an uprising. Nero is one of the top persecutors of the church. And it was during this guy's reign over Rome that Paul is writing, be subject to the governing authorities, for they
that
do what is good.
So hard.
Yeah. Take that for what it's worth. Realize the context that he's in when he's saying, he's still arguing, the authorities are put in place over us by God. Do what is good, and you will receive approval, for he is God's servant for your good. This fits into Paul's theology of all things work together for the good of those who love God. So even if what he's doing is putting you to death for being a Christian and proclaiming the gospel, that is ultimately your good, because you will be with God.
So technically, if we were Christians during Hitler's escapade, we wouldn't run from the government? We wouldn't be like the escaping Jews?
Good question. We'll come across more questions like that. So, but put that a pin in that one and ask it again if we don't kind of talk about it more.
Gotcha.
As we get through. 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17.
Be subject to every human institution for the Lord's sake, whether to a king as supreme or to governors as those who commission he commissions to punish wrongdoers and praise those who do good. For God wants you to silence the ignorance of foolish people by doing good. Live as free people, not using your freedom as a pretext for evil, but as God's slaves. Honor all people, love the family of believers, fear God, honor the king.
Honor the king. Be subject, for the Lord's sake, to every human institution, whether it be the emperor supreme or the governors sent by him to punish those who do evil, praise those who do good. Again, we're seeing the same rhetoric from Peter as we saw from Paul. Point is, they're telling us, do what you're told by the government in these passages. Titus 3:1 says essentially the same thing. He's telling Titus about instructing his church. He says, remind them to be submissive to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good work. Tell your church, submission to authority is a godly trait. Just viewing these passages, it would seem that radical patriotism seems to be the biblical view, that we are supposed to never disobey our government, because Peter and Paul, and Paul again, are telling us, be subject to the governing authorities. They're there for your good. Yeah.
Okay, but what about if they have you do something that's against
good question.
God's law?
I'm getting there.
Because that's... What is right is wrong, what is wrong is right.
Good question. Yeah.
So it would be sometimes.
Steve is building a Lincoln Log House.
Yeah.
We're wrongly convicted.
About to be victorious.
Because that was going to be my question, was what do we do if we're in a government like that?
What do we do? We'll get there. When we get to talking about the willful submission option.
Okay.
But I'm going to look at the biblical support for radical patriotism. We've already seen a little bit of it, Romans 13. Matthew 22, pretty famous passage, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, what is render to God what is God's, you know that. The Pharisees come up to Jesus and they say, show him a coin and say, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And he says, bring the coin. Whose image is this? Caesar's, okay, give to Caesar what is his, give to God what is his. The point being, your image is God's. You're made in the image of God. This coin is made in the image of Caesar. That's the parallel he's drawing. But he's essentially saying, yes, insofar as you interact with the government, be submissive to them. Pay your taxes.
It's actually funny. Yeah. Lots of the money that we have nowadays have people in government.
Yeah. Yeah, and they get that from Rome.
But we're still in
like faces of people.
There's also plenty of examples of people being submissive even to an evil government all throughout the Bible. You got Daniel in Babylon. He shows up with his three friends, and he is very respectful, says, we can't eat your food. But then, so there's that example of disobedience, but then later he is instructed to learn all of the things of the Chaldeans, the sorcerers, and
but he did do it. But he asked permission not to eat the food.
He did.
He didn't say, I'm not eating it. He said, can I
give us a test?
And then I, you know, we're...
Good. But he still submitted
yeah.
to this evil government. Nehemiah does the same thing to Persia, the king's cupbearer. He goes and asks to return to rebuild the wall, and he pays taxes to the Persians while they're under Persian rule.
Well, even Moses went back to the Pharaoh, and it wasn't a demand. Per se, it was a. I mean, he went. He didn't just try to get guys to sneak out of Israel or Egypt and have them run away.
Yeah.
He appealed to the Pharaoh.
He strongly urged.
Well, but he had some backing, but yeah. But it was God that did it, not Moses.
Correct.
It wasn't Moses that brought the plagues.
There you go.
So
we've brought God into it, which is where we wanted to get. Last example would be Israel to Egypt. For 400 years, they remained in Egypt and were slaves. And then something changed, but during that time.
That's a long time.
And even then, they didn't rebel and just leave. They had someone ask on their behalf.
Mm. So this would be the biblical refutation. Moses, as we've already talked about. Some examples of ways that people have done civil disobedience. Moses, as you said, asked. He did so when God told him to and directly intervened on his behalf in the civil disobedience. The book of Judges, it's story after story of conquering nation coming in over Israel and then God raising up a judge, civil disobedience, telling, basically kicking out whoever was conquering them, and then they would descend again into captivity and God would raise up another judge. The prophets... Pretty much every single prophet is an example of civil disobedience. They are God's conduits, speaking for God in the midst of usually a rebellious and wicked nation, telling them, repent, turn back, follow God's ways, and they usually got killed for it. Another really clear example of civil disobedience, where we see direct order and direct refusal to follow those orders, and then the author seems to praise the person who did it would be Exodus 1. You guys know the story with the midwives? So, yeah, at the end of Israel's captivity in Egypt, when they're slaves, the Pharaoh said, you know, we're going to kill all of the kids in...
boys, 2 years and younger.
Yeah, was it...
That was just the sons.
The firstborn sons. Mm-hmm. It wasn't?
Well, yeah, we might be conflating Herod's order to kill when the Messiah came.
Oh, that's true.
I thought it was firstborn son.
Yeah, verse 8, chapter 1 of Exodus. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh stone cities, Pithmoth, Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, the more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter in service, mortar, brick, building. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Sifra and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live. The midwives feared God, did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives. People multiplied and grew very strong. So here we've got an order from the Pharaoh, kill all the boys who are born to the Hebrews. Got to keep their numbers down. Midwives specifically refuse or do not do so, and then lie to Pharaoh about it. And the conclusion, the assessment made by the author of Exodus, Moses, God dealt well with the midwives. He blessed them for this civil disobedience.
He feared God more than feared Pharaoh.
Yeah.
That's good.
So yeah, when God enters the equation changes. You got the example of Jesus turning over the tables. That's civil disobedience. He's not supposed to do that. Got the example of the apostles. Repeatedly, when they are going to the authorities, the Jews of the preaching the gospel, in chapter 4 and chapter 5, both times they're told, stop preaching that Jesus is the Messiah. And they say, we must obey God rather than men. Example in Revelation. So this is chapter 14 and 13 and 14. You got the beast who comes up. We did Revelation about a year ago now. The beast comes along and marks so many people with his mark. And there are people who refuse to take the mark of the beast, and the beast kills them. That happens in chapter 13. Okay. Chapter 14, we find out God's assessment of those people. Chapter 14, verse 9. Another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anybody worships the beast in his image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also shall drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and the presence of the Lamb. So he's saying, if you acquiesce to this government, the beast, take his mark, you're going to be damned. Meaning, the civil disobedience would be the correct course of action. Refuse the mark and be killed for it. All of these would suggest radical patriotism. Following what your government says every time is not the correct view to hold. Which leaves us with willful submission. And I would say that this probably is the most biblical. Render to Caesar, again, what is Caesar? But, the second half of that, render to God, what is God's? Yes, submit, but as Denise said at the very beginning, God is the higher authority. There's plenty of appeals to conscience and morality. James 4, which says, James 4:17, I can't remember it. I have to look it up.
Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins.
Yeah. Therefore, if you know what is good and do not do it, it is sin. This is what he's talking about. I think eating meat sacrificed to idols, or is he talking about?
He's talking about boasting about tomorrow.
Thank you.
Today or tomorrow, when you go to this city or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, make money. Well, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're on this earth for a little while and then vanishes. Yeah, yeah.
Instead, what was the first one again? If you know that it's this is the first season.
Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it, that's actual.
So, say Spider-Man decided not to be a superhero, he would technically be a villain because he knows he can do the right things, but he chooses not to.
Yes. Which, actually, that's also in James. Essentially that proverb of...
Right.
Yeah. With great power comes great responsibility. That's essentially in the Bible. Bible. Yeah. Slightly different wording, but same idea. There's the various references to obey God's law first, and then man's law second. Acts 5:29, we must obey God rather than man. John 19:11... which I vaguely remember being really cool when I put it in there, given the context, and now I don't remember what the context is. Let's look it up. Oh, yeah. When Jesus is being delivered over to Pontius Pilate, he's talking with him, and Jesus said, Pilate says, you don't know that I have the authority to release you. Talk to me. And Jesus says, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. Again, Jesus very clearly is stating that God's authority is higher than the governmental human authority. So, part of the willful submission thing is being willing to accept the governmental punishment for your disobedience. You've got the examples of Jesus, pretty clear example of someone who did willful disobedience and accepted the consequences. Paul, over and over and over again, whenever he would preach the gospel and then be stoned or something. Also, in contrast, you've got Paul when he finds out about the plot to stone him and he escapes, which means that there's some biblical support for the idea of avoiding the consequences. It's very much dependent on the conscience. That's why I say revert back to conscience. Paul talks about this when they're arguing over eating meat sacrificed to idols. I think it's 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 8, 9, somewhere in there. Essentially, when he's telling them about eating meat sacrificed to idols, yeah, if it's 8, if your conscience is clear, go ahead and do it, but don't do it unless it would cause your brother to stumble. Essentially, if it's an amoral action, neither good nor bad, there's no morality that enters into the question, do whatever you want. As long as you're comfortable in your conscience with it. As long as you feel that you're doing what is right. That's all I wanted to present on civil disobedience. Everybody pretty much on board with that? Know some of the basic biblical patterns we see? This is what we're going to be doing with lots of these things. We're going to be looking at the biblical patterns, see if there's any specific directions in the Bible, and then the rest is up to you. Separation of church and state. First of all, note that it's not the separation of God and state and not the separation of morality and state. Very clear from what we saw earlier that the writers of the Bible expect the state to be acting morally and expect the state to be acting in accordance with what God has ordained as his authority. This is specifically the separation of the church and the state. So, what is the church? When did it start? What are the qualities of the church as distinct from God?
When I think of this, I think of like the how the Catholic Church was sort of over. Is it East or West Rome?
Probably Western Rome.
Western Rome. Way back in before the Middle Ages. So, like, just these, there is a separation between the church, the whatever church you're a part of, and the moral systems of the state.
Yeah. Good. There's separate institutions. Yeah. The church began at Pentecost, Acts 2 is where it started. It will end one day. It's the establishment of Jesus. It's his institution that he had the apostles fulfill and establish. Throughout church history, we've got different examples of degrees of separation between church and state. At the very beginning, you have full separation. The apostles are going around preaching the gospel pretty much in defiance of the state and completely separate from it, saying, we must obey God rather than man. This is what we're doing. This is what Christ instructs us to do.
Well, technically, wasn't that been separated from the established church at the time?
Yeah.
The Jews? I mean, so they were their own thing.
Yeah, it was separate from
the church.
From Judaism, yeah. Yeah, and I want to be real clear here. When I'm talking church, I say I'm specifically saying Christian church. The ecclesia started in Acts 2, ends in... So... Different from separation of religion and state, I guess, is the way I'm talking about it. But yes, they were also separating from the established religion at the time in their context. Constantine comes along. Think back to your church history. What was it, 312? He moves the capital over to Constantinople and...
Istanbul.
No,
Constantine. He does that and legalizes Christianity, and we see a whole lot more cooperation between the church and the state. A whole lot of people become Christians at that point because it's the fashionable thing to do. Move church history along a little bit further. Think back, as Nathan was talking about, you get down towards the Charlemagne era, 900s and Dark Ages, and you've got the church is the state. They are fully united. There is no separation. And the churches and the state are conquering lands and converting, forced conversions. And I gave you pros and cons of each of those eras on your thing. In the early church, you got persecution and holiness, but a lack of uniformity. Everybody is meeting in their separate churches in the secret, and essentially there's hidden heresies cropping up that they're not able to deal with because they can't come out in the open and talk about it. You get the cooperation era. The pros would be creeds and clarity. Constantine calls these councils, and you get our most foundational creeds that Christians believe, clarifying the Trinity, denouncing heresies that were coming up in those first 200 years. But, unfortunately, you have a lack of complete sincerity. Lots of people are becoming Christians because it's the fashionable thing to do. In the Holy Roman Empire, you have unity. Unity and clarity. What the church says is clear, and everybody has to obey it, but there's a definite lack of purity in the church. It is the most corrupt period of church history, in terms of the church and state. So, which is right, I don't know. I tend to think the more separation, the better.
Of church and state.
Of church and state. But there are pros and cons of each. And there's not a whole lot of clear things. This is, again, kind of where do you come down on it. One thing I'm confident of is that both institutions will end. Church will come to an end at the second coming, and we will enter into eternity, and the state will be Christ, and will go into complete unity without the lack of purity. We won't have sinful humans mucking up the works.
It's hard to make a wall for the good of society, the protection of society, without taking a biblical precept into mind when you're doing it.
Yeah.
Because God writ the law in our hearts. I mean, we're made with the law in our hearts. Knowing what wrong, right, and wrong is. And if God has established government, then that law itself is what protects us. Even our forefathers, John Adams, before I use this all the time, but he acknowledged that man cannot govern himself, that he's not capable of doing that. So there has to be that. Another point I'm going to make.
I would refer back to the beginning of, it's not separation of God and state, because the Bible is very clear that the state is supposed to be subject to God. So if we got that correctly, then church and state separation kind of solves itself. If the state is properly following God and the church is properly following God, we got
to. The other point I want to make is this is where the church comes in. We have a social security system. Mm-hmm. We have a welfare system. Our healthcare system. All of which were originally started by the church. School system, you know, adoption agencies.
Wait, started by church, what do you mean by that?
They were started by Christian organizations.
Initially.
Like the government was not responsible for orphanages, even universities.
Charlemagne was the first one to come up with the concept of school.
Yeah. So
as part of the church.
So in other words, if the church had lived up to its obligations of what it was intended to do. You go back to the book of Acts and you see how the church took care of the needs, then the government would not have been able to step in.
They wouldn't have needed to.
Well, they wouldn't need. Nobody would have expected or allowed the government to step in. But because because of where we are, we've got these systems, and now they've become such a part of our experience that they've become entitlements.
Yeah.
That this is the government. It's our right to get these things. Healthcare,
correct.
Education.
And you're starting to get into something I wanted to talk about and I just didn't, but we can go ahead and talk about it, which is what is the function of government and the function of the church?
Right.
The function of the church is to preach the gospel and to do good in society. The function of the government, according to Genesis 9, and it would seem others, is to punish wrongdoing.
Protect.
And protect.
Right. So protect, to protect the people, to, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, so that if those two institutions were to remain in their proper functions, we wouldn't have a lot of the problems with separation of church and state that we do. So as you're describing, it's when we get crossover that issues begin forming. And so this is where this whole separation of church and state becomes a huge debate on the political scene.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that I'll say is that since we do have a staff member in the kitchen, that system has infiltrated the church in so much as instead of us doing ministry ourselves, we are paying people to do it for us.
Paying into the system. Yeah.
So it's easier for us to
turn the church into a business.
And I know that's what Stephen wants to go become a pastor, but I mean, there are those.
I don't want my church to be a business.
But, right. Paul even says, you know, to remunerate. Is it to pay?
Yeah.
Yes, to pay. You know they've got to pay the bills.
Yeah.
Those are called the ministry, but we let that go to the nth degree because we've lost sight of what we're supposed to be doing as a church.
Yeah.
Why we can't get more volunteers for a certain for ministry?
You just think,
we don't have
we're
to.
Paying people to do that.
We can pay them. And so, and that's controversial in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I think there's some truth in that.
Again, what is the function of the church, and what is the function of society? Good questions. We're gonna move on to immigration at this point. We're gonna look at the popular views, a few biblical insights, and then I'll give you my view. This will be a little bit controversial because I think I probably disagree with some people in here, but there's two basic popular views. One, illegal immigrants are lawbreakers and should be punished accordingly. Two, illegal immigrants are more like refugees and should be treated mercifully. Those are the underlying ideologies behind the whole question of illegal immigration and immigration.
Some of those are strongly correct.
Both extremes.
So the first one, we should build a wall.
Yes. In general, you're going to see Republicans landing on this one and Democrats landing on that one. But we're not going to get political parties till the end of that. We're going to try and keep political parties at least a little bit out of it until the end. We will get there. But I'm going to give you some biblical insights just in the whole surrounding the question of immigration. First of all, you got the Mosaic Law. So we're looking at Israelite society, not American society. Remember that. But in Leviticus chapter 19, you guys should read the book of Leviticus, by the way. It's one of the best ones in the Bible.
Yeah, it is.
We have it at
one
Bible study this next semester. Mm-hmm. It's
quite a lot of hard
stuff. In the Mosaic Law, just after giving the "Be ye holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy," the essence of the law, he goes on, he talks about how are we supposed to treat the sojourners. And it's in the midst of this that we have the famous love your neighbor as yourself thing. So he's telling them how they're supposed to live in the society. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to the edges, neither shall you gather the gleaning from your harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyards bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes from your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. You shall not steal, you shall not false, deal falsely. You shall not lie to one another. You shall not swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of the Lord. I am the Lord your God. You shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you and all night until morning. With you all night until morning. You shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall fear your God. I am the Lord. You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be impartial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So these are the instructions God, Yahweh, is giving to the people of Israel, ancient Israel, how they're supposed to operate. And one of the things in particular he tells them is, do not reap the corners of your land, leave that for the sojourners, take care of them. In our vernacular, we'd say the immigrants. But also, in that exact same section, verse 15, you shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or to the rich. In fairness, you shall judge your neighbor. So both of those views that we presented earlier have a little bit of weight in this exact same section. Verses 33 through 34 mention, again, taking care of the sojourner in the land. Hebrews 13, you're supposed to welcome the Christians that you don't know, the strangers who are brothers. Welcome them. What is it? Let brotherly love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware. When you got a stranger coming in, show hospitality to them. Luke 13:29 and Revelation 7:9 both references to the fact that every tribe, every tongue, will be represented in eternity. There are people from all nations, so any kind of immigration ideals that you have that are racially motivated should not be so. You should not be partial or making your statements based on where somebody is from or what language they speak, because there's going to be people from every single one when we get to the other side. And then you've also got, again, balancing the scale a little bit, 2 Thessalonians 3, he who shall not work shall not eat. Essentially saying, you gotta earn your spot, earn your keep. We worked when we were among you, and if somebody's not pulling their weight, they don't get their fair share. So this plays into the immigration debate, because everybody on one side is saying, we're all just freeloaders who are coming, stealing all of our stuff and not paying into the system, but reaping the benefits, which is a bit of a problem. They're coming in and stealing our jobs. They're sending that over their rapists and the worst of the worst. You gotta have a balance. There's the various sin lists of Paul. 1 Corinthians 6, Galatians 5, Ephesians 5. In them, Paul includes thieves and swindlers. People who break the law. Could illegal immigration be considered theft in that way, that you are stealing citizenship? Paul recognizes and uses his own Roman citizenship for his advantage. He recognizes that there are benefits to being a citizen and that other people don't get those benefits. He recognizes laws that are appropriated to him as a citizen. So, and particularly in illegal immigration, should we be allowing those benefits to be going to people who do not get to partake? These are, I'm hoping what you're seeing is that there's a little bit on each side from those two views that we presented at the beginning.
Yeah, but why are illegal immigrants getting work? Who's hiring them?
Yeah.
So we have to look at that factor. They're being hired because they cost less. So, really the responsibility is the citizen
us.
Who's doing it.
Good point. All these for you to think about, weigh for yourself and consider, and I'll give you my view, where I stand on it. And I break it down into institution, personally, and policy. So, institutionally speaking, what should our laws be? We should be respective of the laws and support strict enforcement of citizenship and immigration. We should not be tolerating illegal immigration, and we should be trying to enforce the immigration laws that we have.
Or else not have the law.
Or else not have the law.
Or
on a personal level, personally, with the people that you know, be helpful, humble, forgiving to illegal immigrants, recognizing their struggles. I do personally know many people who either were illegal immigrants or are descendants of illegal immigrants who came here illegally. And I, when you put faces on these people, instead of just talking about them like them, this innocuous, inhuman species, it gets a little bit harder to be as dogmatic on the more Republican side of things. As a form of policy, what policy do I support? Which ones do I think are the best? Some sort of path to citizenship while increasing border security and decreasing immigration. That's where I land. I tend to think that on a Christian worldview, those who are already here and establishing lives and working and contributing to society, as we've seen, we should be merciful and allow them some way of becoming citizens. However, we should also be working to prevent future illegal immigration, not saying, look, we're taking whoever wants it and here's an easy way to become a citizen, just break the law and then we'll forgive you. That's the where I land in terms of policy. Does that help a little bit on the immigration? Problem is, the Bible doesn't really address the subject of immigration as we have it today, as we're going to see with a lot of these worldview things, which is why they're hot topics of discussion, because it gives us principles in different contexts, and we have to translate those to our context. How do we do that is the question. Moving on, last 10-15 minutes. Political parties and government involvement. So this is where it can get fun. First of all, I want to make sure, particularly for the younger people in here, that you know the difference between conservative and liberal and Republican and Democrat.
And right and left.
Conservative and liberal are two ideologies, and Republican and Democrat are two parties. So, generally speaking, Republicans are usually conservative and Democrats are usually liberal. But they're not synonymous. You can be a liberal Republican and you can be a conservative Democrat. Republican and Democrat are the two major parties in our system. Liberal and conservative are the two major ideologies in our system. What are those ideologies? Conservative means we're conserving. You tend to have more of a traditional view of morality. You want to conserve the good things in society, sort of getting back to the good old days, you might think of it. Liberal means you want looser rules and to move forward into uncharted territory. Usually progressive liberal would do that. You want to progress and see new things, and the old ways have been tried and tested, and you're saying we need to get beyond those. Those are the general ideologies.
And conservative will also mean it tends to lean more towards personal responsibility.
Correct.
Versus
relying on the state.
Liberal ideologies would tend to look more of a
being more. I mean, to use the word compassionate, I guess, towards those who are.
I would use the language of individualistic and community state oriented.
Yeah.
Do you look at yourself as your own entity and self-sufficient, or do you look at yourself as state-oriented, as we're all in this together and we all need to be working with each other?
Here I go one more. Conservative also means, because it's individualistic, there tends to be more freedom. Liberal will tend to look to a the government for their help.
Their needs.
And so it's more, I can't do this, I need somebody to help me do this, versus somebody helping and doing it themselves, being self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Self-sufficient, independence versus dependence.
There you go, independence versus dependence, I think. Liberals would also argue that they're the more ones who are for freedom, though. The liberty thing is, we should all be free to do what we want.
And they'll say freedom
least.
From a freedom too.
Oh, good. What do you mean?
Freedom from oppression. Freedom from the state running the church. Freedom to is freedom to do whatever you want. Freedom to smoke marijuana. Yeah. Freedom to drink alcohol. Or whatever the case is.
Good.
Freedom from versus freedom to.
Yeah.
But it all depends. It all points to who's ultimately responsible for how they live.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? Should I be able to make that decision, or should the government make that decision for me? That's the
keep your paws off my lawn.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always work out that way.
Correct.
It's pick abortion.
Right. Well, I know. See, but that's the hypocrisy. Because we want freedom. We want the government to step in. On the liberal side, we want the government to step in on just about everything. Education, health care, but we don't want them stepping in when it comes to a woman's
more
sexual liberty.
Any kind of morality issue.
Any moral issue is, you know.
They want to separate it.
Well, no, they want the government to it's got to be okay to have gay marriage. The government has to, right now, the government
has
to step in and make it right. When it's morally wrong, but what's that?
The government has it. The president's overstepped his boundaries.
Well, but but in states it's been voted in. But I'm saying that it's a law.
This is why I want to be clear on the difference between conservative and liberal and Republican and Democrat. Some of these things are party things. I tend to think specific issues. You take a party platform that says these are the issues and this is what we think on all these issues, but you might not agree with all of those and they might not be right, and I want to discourage the strong and vehement conservative versus liberal, Democrat versus Republican. However, I want to also encourage know who you are and where you land. The demonization of the other side is what I want to get along. Sometimes the other side is flat out categorically wrong. They are morally incorrect. Sometimes they're not, and we just paint with a broad brush and say, all liberals are idiots, or all Republicans can't think for themselves.
I can give you a Democrat and a Christian.
Sorry?
I would say, well, that's a question that I don't, you know, I've heard that, you hear that a lot. How can you be a Democrat and a Christian?
Yeah. And that's
a silly question.
Yeah, it's a silly question. What they mean is all of these issues that the Democrat Party supports, the stance that they take on these issues, how can you as a Christian affirm those stances on those issues? Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, the Democrat Party is the one that is pro-abortion. And generally speaking, I would say Christians should be against abortion. So how can you be a Christian and be a Democrat?
Well, I was raised in a Democratic family, Democratic place. You know, I was raised in Berkeley, California. Everybody's a Democrat. And the reason a lot of that was, and a lot of it is for Republican too, it's just families in the past have been this. So the children take it on. And unless they are in something like this that really examines why they're a Democrat or why we're Republicans, you know, they'll just keep up with the family tradition. And I have a lot of friends who are Democrats. They don't know why.
Yeah.
They're going to vote for Hillary because she's the party. So they're voting the party. Mm-hmm. And so,
which is what you're getting at, which someone also wanted to hit on, was this is why when we think back to when we started going through the Bible, we had a whole lesson on how to think. Because we don't teach you how to think anymore. And think through these things, and they sort themselves out. And it's this blind following of leaders oh yeah, I'm voting for so-and-so. Why? Well, because my party told me to.
Exactly. They don't want to get to know the candidate, so they just vote the party.
Yeah, they don't want to think.
Yeah.
They don't want to... takes time and effort to think. It's much easier not to.
I've run across people in Houston that are like that.
Yeah.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
I've heard in college and since then, people getting frustrated with people that, like, single-issue voters,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. I don't know. I mean, I myself have been a single-issue voter, but that's not necessarily for one party or the other, but because if this party believes a certain way about this issue, then chances are they're going to believe the same way that I do in these other issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use that kind of as my watermark, so to speak, or whatever, my benchmark.
Yeah.
And go from there. But then there's some people that are very much against that because they're saying you're not looking at all the issues. You're not...
Correct. And again, thinking. What you're doing is you're taking a logical approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
An example of how this might play out, of why the party system is a good one, is when you're in the ballot box and you're casting your vote and you have to pick between about 60 different people for different offices. You literally can't research all of them, know what they believe about everything. And so they tell you, I'm part of this party. So you know that they're going to represent these general values that you hold,
right.
Which helps in making you say, oh, okay, well, I'll vote for this party person instead of that party person. And you have to make the choice over all these different people.
A
lot of people vote just a party.
Yeah, you vote a party ticket.
You're not guaranteed that your candidate's going to follow the platform.
Yeah, but you can't guarantee that. And so, and then there's other things there's other parties, too. We live in a two-party system where two parties are dominant, but there are other parties. And speaking candidly, I'm predicting that the party system is going to be changing in the next 15, 20 years because of what's going on in this election cycle. You're going to see libertarians gaining a little bit of ground from both parties. You're going to see the Green
Party.
You're going to see the Tea Party's probably split off, and there's going to be some shifts in our party system. But
because they've been too similar.
Correct.
The parties have been too similar for too long, mm-hmm. but there's nothing differentiating them.
Yeah.
They've been polarized. You look at voting records in Congress of Republicans and Democrats over the last 100 years, and I actually saw this charted out where you had red and blue, and each dot was a particular senator. And essentially, it's just every vote down through the years. Well, no. 70, 80 years ago, there was a spread. You had lots of red over here, lots of blue over here.
It's kind of cloudy.
Yeah, and through the years, you saw it separate out. All of the red started grouping further and further over, and all the blues started grouping further and further. So the parties got polarized as to the point where we got into this mentality of, oh, I'm a Republican, I vote Republican, I vote with my party. I vote the party.
And that's what I was taught to do.
Instead of being okay voting with somebody just because they call themselves a Democrat, you vote for them based on what they believe,
mm-hmm.
Based on the party that they hold. All that to say, I am a registered Republican, and I can't bring myself to vote for either of these two candidates who are running for president right now, so I'm going to be either voting third party or casting a blank ballot.
For president.
Just to let you know. For president, yes. In the minor elections, I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet. But
that's a conscience issue, though.
Yeah.
Because not voting is a vote for your opponent candidate.
I disagree with that. But
Technically
speaking, that's logically inaccurate. Not voting is not a vote for someone else. It's simply not a vote. However, I understand the point that you're making, and that you're.
What I'm saying is that if you tend to lean more towards one than the other, and you evaluate which, I hate to use the lesser two evil argument, but
it's avoiding the evil one to get into office.
It's you gotta
more evil one.
You gotta take a stand. But
if you don't vote, it's
I respect your opinion.
Yeah,
and that's what you want to do, but just. I just think that anybody who does that, I've heard that from many people.
Yeah.
And it's just, you have to, it's
everybody,
huh?
If everybody who voted on either side
decision like that, in your logical way, who is the least likely in this particular case to not vote because of their conscience over the two candidates? It comes down to the knowledge of the vote, right?
Yeah.
I don't disagree that either candidate is one we really want, but then again, look around us. Who else is
Well, now, I'll explain, again, the whole thinking thing. I'll explain my thought process a little bit more. I actually do have an ideal recourse of why I'm doing this way.
I mean, I respect
No, let me work it out, though. Were neither candidate to get a majority of electoral college, as in if a third party candidate, say Gary Johnson, I'll throw him out there, were to get enough of the electoral college so that no one person got a majority of the electoral college,
mm-hmm.
the Congress then decides the president,
right.
regardless of the popular vote and the electoral college vote. So if enough people were to vote for the third party, not obviously not enough to get him elected, but enough to draw from both candidates that no one person got a majority of the electoral college, Congress would choose. Congress is run by party-lined Republicans right now, and they would put up their own candidate, somebody like a Paul Ryan or a Jeb Bush, and given the choice between Jeb Bush, Donald Trump, or Hillary Clinton, I'd vote Jeb Bush every time. So essentially what I'm doing with my vote is going on that long shot idea that no one gets a majority of the electoral college vote.
Okay, so...
Which is why I don't agree with the a vote, no vote is a vote for the other person, because there's a lot of people on the other side who are thinking like me.
Okay, here's what has to happen though.
Let's talk. I'm happy to talk about this further, but let's get through the end of the discussion.
This is one guy, and we will stop.
Okay. Yes, Ross Perot.
Ross Perot sucked
up the vote and ruined it for the Republicans that year.
No, I wasn't going to say that.
Okay.
I was going to say that Ross Perot won 20% of the vote and did not get one electoral vote.
Yeah, I know. And I realize my particular vote doesn't matter at all because I'm in Texas. Texas is going red regardless, so it really doesn't matter who I vote for the president.
But if
New Mexico and Arizona were to go after Johnson, they have enough that nobody would get the electoral vote. We got a little bit onto a tangent. Let's finish up. The Democratic Republic of the U.S., as you can see, there's people in here who are involved in their government. They participate. They care about who's leading, and they participate by voting. Another misconception that many of our youth live with is that we live in a democracy. We don't live in a democracy. We live in a republic. You can throw on democratic republic if you prefer. But for proof of this, you guys know the Pledge of Allegiance, right? Go ahead and say it with me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the
Republic for which it stands.
Republic for which it stands. The Republic is the system of government that we're under. The flag represents that republic. So in a republic, we elect representatives to basically fight for us on the governmental level. So we also, in our, we have a democratic republic in that we, the democracy, the people, get a say. We vote for those representatives. Those representatives aren't selected for us regardless of our opinion. The way our Constitution works, we are asked to participate in our government. So as Christians, submitting to the governing authorities might mean rebelling against them. Again, our Constitution gives us the right to overthrow our government if it becomes tyrannical. These are things that civil disobedience is actually obedience to the governing bodies, to the governing laws of our land. So the Christian has more complex ideas to think of with the American system. And the philosophy behind the American system was largely Christian. I don't want you guys to, again, get on that misinformation that all of the founding fathers were deists. Many of them were. There were also some Christians who were committed actual Christians. Ben Franklin, the most deistic of any of the founding fathers, still prayed in the name of Jesus on the floor of Congress. Documented. You can go find the prayers that he prayed. He was the big deist. He was the number one deist of all of them, but still recognized the influence of Christianity and Christian thought. So the philosophy that laid the foundation for America is distinctly Christian. Let me put it that way. All of that to say, though, not everybody lives in America. other governments operate differently, and they are responsible for being subject to their governing authority. So something to always remember, this is what we started this with, was Philippians 3:20 and 21. Our citizenship is in heaven, and from it we await the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body to be like his glorious body by the power that enables him even to subject all things to himself. Thinking beyond both now in the past direction and in the future direction is key to understanding how you operate with your government. Recognize the past, where our government came from, the philosophies that laid the foundation, what they thought. Recognize the past of how Christians have interacted with their governments in all different ages, whether it be a monarchy, a tyranny, a democratic republic. What say you? And also, look towards the future, that this government will end. Our citizenship is in heaven. We await a Savior who will come down and establish a new kingdom, the kingdom of God. He will rule, he will reign. There's that balance to be had. Lastly, some further study for you, sources for you guys to check out. Books, particularly the podcast, The Briefing, is a great podcast. Albert Mohler, it's a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. He does a great job of teaching his listeners how to think through issues of the day. He essentially reads the major newspapers and then summarizes it for you and then gives the Christian worldview of it. So with what we're going to be doing in here, Albert Mohler does every day on The Briefing. Really great podcast. I listen to it every day. There's a good blog by one of my professors, Dr. Woods, The Word on Politics. He was a PhD law professor before he became a seminary and Bible college professor. So he has a very good view on politics.
You didn't write these references down.
I didn't. Again,
That's right.
I had to choose between fitting the further study things on there and keeping it all on one page. So, but these, again, will be on the website, mygiveonthings.com. You can go and download the PowerPoint.
What is it again?
Mygiveonthings.com.
Where other people might have a take.
Yeah.
Mygiveonthings.com.
That's my tagline.
So this is going to be on there.
So yeah, go to the home group tab and the PowerPoint will be up there and you can download the PowerPoint to see all these. That is all. Any last thoughts, questions? Anybody else want to argue politics before we leave?
What about the church institution going away? Where did that come from?
Just that the church...
I mean, they'll be united with Christ as a bride, right?
Correct.
So it's not going away.
Well, the church age will end.
Yeah. The church as the distinct conduit of God's revelation for this age.
Whether the presence... Or God's presence here on earth.
My dispensationalism is seeping through on that. And that essentially, I think Israel's coming back in the picture, and we will be a united Israel and church. New Jerusalem will be what we are. So we will be the people of God united fully in the future. So the distinctives of the church will go away. And then as we are distinct from Israel now, we're grafted in, but distinct, there will no longer be a distinction. Put it that way. But also... Not a huge sticking point if you want to put it that the church won't end and that church members are eternal beings who will be saved into the New Jerusalem. Yeah, we won't end. So in that sense, it will not.
The church will not be needed at some point.
Question from the audience, just real quick. It's important.
Yeah.
So here's
the challenge. I appreciate that.
We'll look at Micah 6.
Yep.
Micah 6:8.
He showed the old man what is good and what the Lord requires.
There's a context there. We don't have to go into the context of Micah 6:8. It's a standalone verse. Real quickly, can you do it? Are they principles? Or are they descriptive that you go do every single day?
Every day.
Because you know what to go do.
every day. It's a lifestyle. It's a way of life.
It's
a world view.
Oh, minus 6.
You know, he says, you know, oh man, what is required. But what is good? You know, oh man, what is good? Or, yes, it says, he has told you. This is it. He has told you, he being God, has told you, oh man, what is good. And it's important in regards to the context that you were talking about.
Yeah.
To do what?
Justice.
To do justice. I actually like the King James version myself there.
To do justly?
To do justly, because it's a verb adverb combo there.
Yeah.
But no words. Okay. To do justly, to so love mercy.
Yeah.
Love mercy. And to walk humbly before your God. What would that look like in our daily lives, regardless of our government?
And that's what I was hoping to drive
by. Regardless
of our government.
Thanks,
right? We have had a benefit the last 254 years, roughly, of a government that is strongly, strongly influenced by Christian values. Without a doubt, you look at the Constitution, the way it was written. The men who signed it, who gave up lives and property and families.
Well done.
That had to die. What would you do?
Well done, 105. Well done, 56.
Go to Matthew 5 and
7. Oh, I don't want to forget it.
Anyway, there you have it. Welcome to my...
Thanks for preparing.